Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 373, we are previewing the January 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. This is our first episode of 2023, and we have several topics to discuss. Joining me for this discussion, Drs. Safa Rahmani, Kat Talcott, and Sarwar Zahid. We start with a discussion of coding for geographic atrophy and some of the coding challenges that may face us in 2023, some drugs hitting the market potentially. We then move on to a discussion of private equity. There's an article written in this month's issue about private equity from the perspective of a partner and what it means for young retina specialists. We dive into this. We then talk a little bit about biomarkers for DR as well as early worsening of diabetic retinopathy. Is this a thing that does happen with anti-diabetic drugs? What does the literature say? As always, you can find a list of relevant financial disclosures in the episode description. You can also find a link to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website and get CME credits for this episode and many other episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a preview of the January 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. Yes, 2023 is here. Joining me for this episode, I have three of my colleagues and friends from around the country in alphabetical order. First, Dr. Safa Rahmani from Chicago. Safa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I have Dr. Catherine Talcott from Cleveland. Kat, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
And last but not least, unfortunately, probably always last in the alphabet, dating back to kindergarten, Dr. Sarwar Zahid from New York. Sarwar, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be back. Thank you.
You know, Yoshi and you haven't done an episode together, but he would be happy to do one because I always make fun of him for being back of the room in school. So
I was going to say, I never get the first.
No, yeah, seriously. So we have four articles to discuss. Remember, Retinal Physician, the articles are available online at retinalphysician.com for free. Let's kick off 2023 with a discussion. There's an article written by Suzanne Corcoran. And just for background, Corcoran, they do a lot of consulting for coding and billing in ophthalmology. So she wrote a Q&A, which is relevant to geographic atrophy. I think one of the biggest news that we anticipate with 2023 in our space is going to be treatment for GA. We have two drugs as of today, December 18th, 2022, recording that are under review by the FDA for approval. We have Apellis' drug, Syfovre, pegcetacoplan, and we have Zimura from Iveric Bio. We'll probably get it sounds like we're going to get a decision on Apellis' drug, which is Syfovre first, but we may have N2023, but that as many as two options to treat GA. So she just runs through less the science, but more the coding, right? So she talks about how GA is defined, the testing that normally is used, including OCT and exam and fundus photos. And then she talks a little bit about the trial data just for completeness sake, which we've covered in depth here, but again, you know, phase three trials for, you know, Apellis and Iveric have shown reduction of progression of geographic atrophy in the patients who were treated versus sham patients. And then they talk about the code that we use, which would be your intravitreal injection code, 67028. There isn't a J code, of course. And, you know, I think we always ask this, J codes are very important for new drugs and there won't be a J code until something is approved. And the last thing, again, it's very similar, is so what do you have to document when you do an injection, right? Same things we do now, why you did the injection, which eye you injected, what was the procedure like, the drug description dose. I think all of us using EMR will probably have a very similar template when we start injecting this drug. And then reimbursement, right? So the one question she asks is, what happens if you have to treat wet AMD at the same time as dry AMD? You can only submit one code essentially for 67028 in a day. And I assume that'd be for the eye, for each eye. She doesn't really go into that here, but I'm sure people do treat bilaterally and get reimbursed. So I think she's referring to, if you did two 67028s in the same eye, that would be a problem, assuming it was the same day. And then samples, of course, would not be reimbursed. I think that's also, so some of this, you know, I'll start with you, Safa. I think a lot of this was sort of recap. I don't think there's anything really groundbreaking. I think the most interesting thing to talk about is, which people have brought up, we don't have any scientific data about how you treat wet AMD and dry AMD the same eye. That wasn't evaluated in trials. And then now we know we don't get paid for it, right? So when people start having to do this, so let's say we do incorporate a dry AMD injection into your practice. Let's say the patient converts to wet AMD. What are we going to do? What would you do if you had a patient who converted?
My suspicion is that without the lack of data, I'm going to switch and just treat the wet AMD and not concurrently treat the dry. That's my suspicion because I don't have enough data to prove or disprove that both of them would work at the same time. And logistically, I think it'll be much harder to do two injections in one eye. The risk of anophthalmitis goes higher, risk of, eye pressure issues goes higher. Even if that were to be the correct scientific option, I think we have a lot more risks that we have to deal with if that comes to be the case. So I think without the scientific evidence of what's best, my suspicion would be that I would just completely switch over and stop the dry treatment and start with the wet.
Yeah, you think that would be similar for you? You think most people would do that? They're just not going to continue dry AMD treatment, given that, again, that's a slower moving process?
I mean, I think initially I'll probably focus on the wet AMD. I mean, I have to admit, I hadn't thought about this too much really until I read this article. And I hadn't really, known that in terms of the reimbursement, that we'd only be able to get reimbursed for like one injection per day. Because I think the converse situation is almost more interesting. And I don't know, I'm sure you guys have started doing this a bit, but I've tried to get a feel for who in my practice would be interested in injections. And I think some of the people who would actually be, besides sort of the young people who have like, advanced GA in one eye and then, extrafoveal in the other eye, for like my wet AMD patients, I have had them on injections. If I get them to sort of a maintenance, so like a Q12, like interval, and then they continue to develop atrophy sort of on top of that. So they've already sort of bought into injections, but I think that group of people will be very interested in all sort of treatment because they already know the drill. They feel comfortable with injections. And I think that's going to be kind of the interesting population of what you do with the timing of injections, because obviously, you're going to need to be seeing them more frequently. And ideally, I would have loved to, in some ways, do those injections on the same day. But, as like Safa mentioned, I think there's a number of issues to sort of think through there.
Yeah. I think that Kat brings up some good points about which patients are going to be more accustomed. I mean, I think, and I agree with both you and Safa, Kat. I think that, ultimately, if you think a year or two down the line, there probably will be patients who will go on both treatments once we have some data. The problem is I don't know who's going to be the first to do it and report real world outcomes, right? So you just have to kind of go for it. And then the best you could do, unless you really wanted that patient there every week, every 2 weeks, you'd probably have to stagger. If it's a patient who can extend their wet AMD treatment out to at least 2 or 3 months, then you kind of alternate each month. It's a pretty high treatment burden, Star Wars, though. It's funny because with wet AMD, we're moving away from treatment burden. And yeah, of course, it's better to have some treatment than no treatment. But now we're instituting something that if they convert, now you're adding the treatment burden. It'd be interesting to know, like, what's the number needed? Like, what for each of us, what's our mental calculus for the number of patients to potentially help? But then you increase the treatment burden, give someone a potentially blinding disease that if they miss an appointment, they could lose their vision. How do you sort of factor that in as you look ahead to next year?
I think this is going to be an interesting learning experience for several reasons. Some of the ones we already talked about. I mean, the people who are, say, at stable at 12 weeks, if you start GA treatment in the same eye, that may alter, we don't know the long-term effect. I mean, is that going to change the frequency of injections? Is a Q12 going to become a Q8? And some of these things, whether or not to do an injection on the same day, I mean, assuming you have buy-in from the patient, in the appropriate patient, I think, and I think I'm thinking about all these things as that I was not before, like starting a practice. It's like, okay, well, I mean, for example, a lot of my patients are used to coming back because we don't have prior authorization. I mean, like, I very rarely do an injection on the same day I see a patient. I, try to do it as soon as I possibly can, but unfortunately, with the payers that are in my in my sort of area and my cohort of patients, I have no choice but to do that. But if you add another injection on top of that, that would totally affect how frequently the people are coming in. Honestly, it's been a bit more challenging for me to think about because the majority of my patients are diabetic. I probably have, you know, maybe, you know, 10% of my patients are dry AMD, you know, 5% are wet AMD. So I have probably 3 or 4 patients who have early GA, who I think would be really good candidates. But I think a bigger challenge with this patient population is getting that buy-in. I mean, like, you know, like Kat, you were saying, Kat, earlier, is, you know, you have buy-in from injections. You know, we're trying to prove a negative here, right? And it's easy, you know, you can show a patient, you know, okay, look, you had fluid last time, you don't have fluid this time, your vision's 2 lines better. That's great. That's progress. We need to continue this. However, you know, the time course is so much longer. I mean, it's like you can show, you know, so one thing I've been trying to do is have, for the patients who I think are good candidates, have autofluorescence from every visit to demonstrate growth but you're still, to get buy-in, you're still trying to prove a negative. I mean, I mean, after 6 months of injections, hey, look, it started growing a little, you know, it's not growing anymore, you know? So I think how we navigate that is going to be, I think, one of the bigger challenges as well, aside from the billing and injecting in the same eye with the CNV risk.
Yeah, you know, Safa, those are great points by Sarwar, and we'll kind of go around more time to close this topic. I think the interesting thing is, let's talk about adoption. Unfortunately, I think it's going to be driven by how lucrative it is. And I don't say that to be cynical, but I think that if the margins are high enough for most practices, then they'll be motivated to do the imaging and counsel these patients and do the chair time that's needed to counsel these patients. But if the margins aren't there, even if scientifically, like we said, it may be the right thing to do, it becomes really hard, especially given the pressures of modern medical practice, for practices to really invest in buy-in, especially when the physicians themselves, a lot of them may start losing faith because you don't have that, we've talked about this before, you don't have that positive biomarker you can look at and say, oh, that is better. And we're human beings, physicians, like we try to say, okay, we're evidence-based, all this, but we also are guilty of our own psychology. And so I think that will be interesting to be like, well, when you get your first wet conversion, are you just gonna be cool with that? Or are you going to scale down your usage subconsciously because now you're worried about that? If you have a really bad wet conversion, are you going to scale down more than you should, even though the science, because all of us have sort of this number needed to treat in our head and the opposite of that, which is the number needed to prevent harm. So I think that will be really interesting, is that balance, throw in the financial factor for many practices and institutions. I really think that margin will be interesting to see, okay, what is the price point for this? How difficult is this to stock? What is, like, can you buy it in bulk? Is there a rebate program if you're a private practice? And then what does it look like from a reimbursement? Is it really difficult to get it reimbursed by your commercial payers? Or is it easy to get it reimbursed? And that will unfortunately be a lot of what dictates which patients get it.
No, you're absolutely right. I think there's multifaceted to this. And I think the biggest one of the overarching issues that I see as well is we don't have an easy endpoint. You know, like, when do you stop injecting? Do you tell the patient this might be forever? You know, I think a lot of wet AMD patients, at least for my patients, you know, I give them a little hope that, oh, you know, we'll start monthly and there's a good chance that I can push you out. Maybe we won't be able to stop forever, but there's a good chance that I can push you out. I don't think that I can say that for any of these GA patients right now. You know, what is the endpoint? And I know, I'm sure these have been discussed, but I think that is one of the other aspects of what are we going to do? You know, I'm obviously in an academic center, so I think a lot of those details has to be worked out for me. I have absolutely no choice in that matter. But I think in the real world, there's so many different practices that absolutely comes into play.
Kat, any other thoughts on GA treatment? Anything to add?
Yeah, no, I think those are all good points. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of chair time involved in these patients. You know, I think that we all, with our wet AMD and DME and RVO patients, always orient to sort of the OCT, even if their vision is not better, in response to injections, you know, and then hopefully the vision too. But here, the endpoints are different. They're more challenging. They're going to take longer to explain. And then, as was mentioned in the article, you know, we can't even get reimbursed for an OCT and autofluorescence on the same day. So I think there's just a lot of challenges to work through. But that being said, I mean, I think overall it's really exciting, I think, for the field of GA to have treatment, but there are a lot of issues to sort of think through as we potentially have the first treatment.
It, great points. And it's already Kat's point about chair time. I also think that we all do like to spend chair time, especially with the diabetics, because you need to counsel them not just about their retinopathy, but the rest of their condition in their body. But for example, a wet AMD patient, there is some counseling involved, but it's almost easy and quick to do counseling when you know your treatment's probably going to make them better. And they're going to see it and they're going to be invested because they see they get better. This is going to be more laborious. Not to say we aren't up for it and we shouldn't do it, but it's definitely going to be more laborious in terms of telling people, okay, this is how it's actually going to work. Like you were referencing, you could have been this worse, but not that bad.
The thing is, it may take time to show that. So I think, you know, we'll have to gain the trust of our patients. And I think you mentioned the CNV risk as like, is that something that would potentially make you averse to doing something? And the point I really like about what you said about the unconscious things that we do, because we are all susceptible to this, you know, I mean, anytime, you know, especially earlier on, you know, if you have a complication, even if you know scientifically that it's a disease process, or it's like, you know, a 1 in 7,000 chance of something happening, you know, we do alter our behaviors. And I've over the years, you know, I've even noticed myself like, oh, why am I doing it this differently? Oh, because I had this complication last time. I think, you know, we just have to be very transparent, especially because this is something, these are some patients who may have never required injections before these medications have are introduced. So I think we'll just have to be very transparent. It's a bit unfortunate to me just that, you know, there's so many more patients who have dry AMD and lose vision from dry AMD compared to wet AMD. It's unfortunate, like the way the finances of our healthcare system work, that, you know, if this is something that's lucrative, we may work it into our workflow a bit more. And we're seeing that with some other medications, you know, I mean, like, for example, you know, the recent medications by Genentech, great medications, you know, I haven't had a chance to use it because, you know, it's just, it hasn't worked with my current, with the place I currently work at. But unfortunately, these financial considerations are a big part of the business of medicine.
Great points. And speaking of the business of medicine, you know, 2023, GA is going to be a hot two-letter word. PE is still going to be a hot two-letter word. So this article, so I'll be very upfront, and maybe by the time this is posted online, we'll have the author. We don't have the author, so I don't want to bring anyone's name into this. But this was written by someone who writes that they're a partner at Retina Consultants of Minnesota, part of RCA, which is a private equity PE entity in the retina space. And so this is a pretty brief article, just talking, goes into the history of PE, talks about different models of integration we've talked about before, horizontal and vertical integration, and then talks about how PE is here to stay, and that there's controversy and interest, and talks about the negative perceptions. They list out losing autonomy to the, and this is not my words, quote unquote, the private equity goblins, as per this article. Constraints on income, and then positive perceptions, increased scale, intrinsic financial value of practices, which is, we can talk about what that means, but it's very creative wording, and the advantages of the partnership with non-medical business people who may know better how to grow value in a practice. And then the rest of it is essentially all about how RCA is a successful PE and why this person likes it. They say it's just based on their own experience, that of course that they don't know other PEs, and it's important to partner with the right PE, but they talk about how they still run their practice, nothing's influenced by outside influence, and they'll never give up that authority, and don't affiliate with anyone where you might lose your autonomy. It's true that your income will be lower, but don't worry, you'll make that money back later because of the equity that you get. And you talk a little bit about how he can't get into details of the equity, but the equity will, of course, be, again, I quote, fantastic financial opportunity, end quote. And that, so they talk about how RCA is a great group for young folks to join. That's kind of the last paragraph. I have my own thoughts. Why don't we wind it back? What are your reactions when you read this?
I think this is an interesting perspective. I mean, you know, I think I personally have never interviewed at a private equity. I have friends who work for private equity companies. I have friends who work at RCA owned practices. And, you know, I think one of the fears, you know, that the author addresses is the idea of loss of autonomy. These are things that, you know, this is why many of the people who I know are starting solo practices, to not be able to give up this autonomy and be able to control the way they practice medicine. And, you know, I've heard, you know, great things about RCA run practices. You know, I do agree with the author in that, from my hearing stories from my friends, it is different than other PE owned ophthalmology groups. However, one of the challenges is, you know, as I talk to people who are coming out of fellowship and looking for jobs, you know, they're asking, people who ask for advice, you know, not many people come to me for advice, but when they do, they ask me, you know, what about private equity groups. And one of the fears are that, yes, it can be a great financial opportunity. You know, it can be nice to have economies of scale. I've actually heard of some of the deals that some of these private equity companies get when it comes to bulk purchase of medications, the contracts they get from payers because they're such larger groups. And there are economies of scale to be had there. The challenge is a younger associate joining, you know, after a few years after fellowship or immediately after fellowship, is that those benefits are not immediately seen to you. And there are differences. I mean, there are shares that are often given to some of these younger associates. However, there are differences between Class A shares and Class B shares. There are nuances to some of these things, you know, and the challenge and what the author tries to do, it doesn't really allay my, if I were someone looking for a job at a private equity firm, it wouldn't allay my fears that I would be necessarily getting the same benefits that the practice owners have gotten, especially when the deals have gone through and depending on the type of shares that I get.
What do you think, Kat? You have fellows every year. I'm sure they read this or they tell you things. So what do you think?
Yeah, the author clearly has their pitch for PE down. I mean, I was convinced by the end of the article. But I think, as you mentioned, there's a big disconnect for me. Obviously, like, I'm in academic practice, so you know, and I already have a job that I'm happy at. So you know, I'm not in the position of sort of my fellows who are looking at places. But I mean, there's so much fear, I think, among fellows and uncertainty about what PE looks like. And then, you know, it's interesting watching fellows who are trying to get jobs. Some of them will try and avoid, you know, PE, but like stay in private practice. And it's hard, I think, for me watching that, because it kind of feels like inevitable that they will be bought out by a PE thing. I think one of the points that was interesting about this article, and it sort of minimized, I think, you know, those real questions that a lot of people have, is these assurances that these young associates will be happy once they get, you know, the next like transaction for like RCA. And I think one of the questions that I'm left with is that actually going to happen? Because I think that's what a lot of people sort of have questions on, is like, who's going to buy these companies? Like, what is going to be the second sale? You know, what's control and autonomy going to look like then? And I think that leaves a lot of questions.
Safa, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm with Kat and Sarwar. I've actually had quite a few of bad experiences, not personally, but my fellows and previous colleagues who basically were duped by PEs in various shapes or forms. And, you know, basically reaching out to me to make sure that none of my fellows go to these particular practices because they're being run to the ground. Like, I've had multiple experiences with that. I think that the essential problem is that money and medicine at the end of the day does not mix well for patient care. And the whole second transaction is really a big deal. PE, private equity, is in the business of making money. So once they optimize one section in 3 to 5 years, there's nothing left to optimize. Where is that next level? You know, and you can, I mean, I hear these pitches. I'm part of startups. I hear it, you know, it sounds so emboldened and so unreal. And it's so believable because they're so good at giving these pitches. And I really think that patient care is really going to suffer. And this whole overarching, you know, moral injury that the doctors overall are going through is because of that loss of autonomy and, you know, loss of you know, being able to care for patients the way you thought you were going to practice. And this is not just retina. This is not just ophthalmology. This is everywhere. And I think that's going to be a huge issue in 3 to 5 years when these private equities are trying to sell, because that's what they do. This is what they do. And that second sale and third sale is, it's very scary in my mind.
So I think these are all fantastic points. I like to think, and I know that there's no medium and no person that can be completely unbiased. I'd like to think that we try to be very fair on this program. So I will start before I go into things I agree with you guys on with just a couple of things. I would agree with the author that not every PE is the same. Of course it's not. Just that's like saying every retina practice is the same. Of course, absolutely, each entity is going to be different. There's going to be a spectrum of good, bad, and ugly for PE. The second thing I would agree with is, you know, they talk about benefits, and the second thing I would say is they are not the only entity out there interested in money. Healthcare organizations, HMOs, capitated care, even university health systems, sometimes this is a constant pressure on physicians and every type of system. We want to make more money. And that is not unique to PE, although to your point, Safa, PE is defined by it completely in terms of what the goal is. And the last thing I would say, to be fair, is yes, there are going to be advantages for the organization as a whole in growing business value, as he says, by getting quote unquote non-medical experts. Of course, you bring in people who are good at business, they're going to be better at business than a physician on average. I will say this now. So, and I don't want to be harsh, but that this article bothers me, because there's been a whole series of these articles put all over. This is in Retinal Physician. I'm not going to pick on Retinal Physician. I think they do a good job. So we partner with them. There's been articles in Retina Today. There's been articles in Retina Times. There's been panels at, you know, fellow meetings. There's been pamphlets. There's been booths. Like, they are very, very motivated to hire. And so the question when someone really, really wants you to do something is why? And the reason they want that is because, number one, the only way to increase the valuation quickly of a practice is to add more widgets, quote unquote. The only way to add more widgets is to add the people who make the widgets. And the only people who make the widgets in these practices are physicians. They need to hire physicians, and ideally young physicians, because young physicians will be cheaper and will work harder than someone who's mid-career or later. The second point I would make about that is they also really want to hire because the older physicians in these groups are less incentivized to see every additional patient once they've sold. And they, of course, they're saying, well, I already got paid. I'm at a stage in my career. I want to cut back. But that's been maybe accelerated. Could be post-COVID. You know, a lot of people are kind of thinking of cutting back. But it may just be, hey, I got the financial value out of my practice. I don't necessarily want to see 60 to 80 patients a day and do 50 injections for dry AMD and wet AMD. So the older guys are very incentivized to hire people to take over their days and take over their patients and do this. But the final thing to think about is he talks about anytime anyone says something is a fantastic financial opportunity, but they can't get into the details. I mean, that is really difficult. I mean, like you said, saw where I started with this. It's very difficult. And none of us are younger retina specialists or retina fellows coming out. But I just don't imagine that this makes anyone feel better, right? Now, it must make someone feel better because clearly their strategy is to do this over and over and over again. And again, they're smart business people, so they must be getting some benefit out of doing this. Obviously, it doesn't cost them anything, right? Because it's not like they're paying for advertisement space. They just wrote an article and someone submitted it. But I will end with this. I think and I've said this before, it's very, very disturbing how we are asking for every journal article and every conference presentation, every podium talk, hey, here's this form, fill out all your financial disclosures for every company you've had a bite to eat with in the last 3 years. And I think that's appropriate. I'm not complaining about that. Someone's going to go on the podium and talk about how great Vabysmo is for DR. It's helpful to know if they're a consultant for Genentech, but there's never any disclosure of what your equity is and why you are financially incentivized, and you don't talk about it in the article, and you don't talk about it in the byline description. You can just say, hey, I'm an owner, but what does that mean? right? How much money are we talking about here? And then they say, well, I can't do that because I signed a non-disclosure. Well, why did you sign a non-disclosure, right? Well, they made me. Why did they make you? So like, the question always is why. Now, I will say this, you know, someone said, Kat, you were saying like you thought fellows were scared of PE. I'll say in 2022 heading to 2023, I actually don't think my fellows are scared of it anymore. They're sort of resigned. I think people are sort of like, okay, there aren't that many jobs. I'm either going to take this one or I'm going to be staunchly anti-PE and make other sacrifices and do something else. So we're talking about opening your own practice. Some people are thinking about that. They make other sort of, some people are more interested in academics than they were before. Some people say, okay, I'll go work at Kaiser. Some people say, okay, I'll live somewhere I may not have lived otherwise. Some people say, you know what? I need to live in this place and that's the best practice. I'll just take an offer and figure it out later. But this sort of article doesn't make that person feel any more committed or confident. So I have problems with the way, just like I think all of you sort of alluded to, this is happening. I do think that we need some transparency when the business crosses in. Tell us, okay, so how much did you make on that sale? And how much more do you make for every associate who joins your practice, right? Now, they may say, look, you don't ask that of retina-only private practices. They make money off their associates too. Absolutely, they do. And they're no guarantee of partnership. That's true. And we're giving you equity. We're giving you shares. Absolutely. To Star Wars' point, they may be different in how those structure. But there's never anything definite. And then you have to think everyone's got a different timeline here. The timeline for the people hiring you is very different than the timeline for a 30-year-old coming out of fellowship who has 25, 30 years, they hope, to take care of patients. So long monologue / diatribe. But I saw this and it just bothered me because I think at some point, we just need to say, hey, if you're going to do this, you got to tell us more. You can't just tell us a sales pitch. If you're going to write a sales pitch, please don't publish it then. That would be my argument, but I'll let someone else talk. Sorry, any other thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, those are really, really, really good points by everyone. I think what you mentioned about the disclosures is huge because, you know, yes, private practices, retina-only private practice, of course they make money. This is the way the model is, but they're not in a journal that is read by multiple ophthalmologists, retina specialists, young trainees, where it's basically a sales pitch. You know, I agree. It does sound like a commercial. I mean, I don't know how much of it is like Stockholm syndrome, but I think Safa, what you mentioned about mixing money and medicine is a dangerous game. And, you know, as you know, like I've had to have a lot of these discussions with my business partner, you know, I mean, yeah, like I have to pay employees. So I have to think about, you know, reimbursements, you know, so you have to think about money, you know, to balance profit and altruism is a very difficult thing. And I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to do that in my practice. I think that's interesting. The last thing is, it's not as if every job works out. Like, I mean, there's like multiple statistics that, you know, the first job that you're at doesn't necessarily work out. I know from, you know, people in the community that sometimes, you know, some of these big private equity owned practices, sometimes you're not compete as like the entire city, you know? So some of these things, it's like, yeah, there are potential upsides, but in the statistically high chance that it doesn't work out, you have to move to another city.
That's a great point that none of us mentioned was non-compete. I really think as a field, we need to push back against non-competes now that PE is involved, because non-competes always existed, but they were very rarely enforced because it's painful to go find a lawyer as a practice and sue. So you got to really, really not want that person to practice in your city to go through all that, because it's going to take a year or two to figure that out. And it's expensive and it's annoying, but PE companies have lawyers on retainer. It's super easy for them. They're already paying them. Absolutely, they're going to enforce it. They don't want to set a bad example. And through the grapevine, there are already, I've heard examples of this happening, where people have been sued for violation of non-compete for trying to leave and open up shop or do something else within an area. And so you're right, Sarwar, it's really hard because they'll just say, look, just try it out. And if you don't like it, you can leave. Yeah, but where are you going to go, right? You have a family, you might have spouse, kids, they have their own job. Like it's just disappointing. I think there were always, money was always a part of it. Not everyone out there is altruistic, but it's disappointing because these are people who medicine's always been like a field where of apprenticeship and sort of passing on to the next generation and helping people. And these are the people supposedly doing it. And there's no sort of thought of what this means for them families and their lives. So non-compete, Safa, I think non-compete should go. I mean, I think that needs to be something, and no one's going to push for that, but that's a big problem. Kat, any final thoughts?
I just think the language piece that you mentioned is just really funny, because I read this article and it screams like pyramid scream, like a scheme. like are they trying to, is there like a timeshare? Is there some weight loss supplement, some like lotion to make you look like you're 20 years younger coming? It's like a big turnoff.
But you know what's funny though is that that commercial is, I always think that's like, I always thought that commercial must work, because why would you keep doing it otherwise? So even though all of us are like, that really, it turns me off, there still must be a population out there that is like, oh, that sounds like a really great financial opportunity. So I mean, maybe that's what they're going for here, but I think you're right. I think it insults the intelligence of the people they're trying to hire. I also think it's a really like a big euphemism to write it as one of the benefits is the opportunity to uncover and capture the intrinsic financial value of practices. Like that is just essentially saying payout that you get up front. But it's like a very it's a beautifully worded way to say it. Anyway,
poetry. It's poetry.
You guys have been generous with time. We spent too long on this article.
It's in the millions of payouts.
It's in the million. Yeah, I don't know for every group it's the same. Every sale is different. I would say these groups, and sometimes probably in the double digit millions, depending on the size of the practice. But no one talks about that.
It's hard to say no. If
look, this podcast, and I've said this before, is not about the moral thing that people shouldn't do it. That's a whole other different conversation. And you know what?
It's hard to say
now. I believe, as you know, we don't have to get into the politics of that. I believe, look, you build something that's your own. If you want to sell it, you can sell it. The part I personally have a problem with is the trying to like sell people to come on without giving them details. And if people were on board with handshake promises that they were going to be partner, this or that, not rewarding them for sweat equity that was paid in. I mean, that those are my two problems with it. I know other people go even further where they're like, oh, they shouldn't have sold in the first place. Like you said, Safa, that's a whole different conversation. But you guys have been very generous with your time. We were supposed to talk about two other articles. We're just going to fly because we're way over. You know, Lakshman Mulpuri is a residency applicant from Wayne State, but he did a year of research with us here, and he wrote this great article. You know, I tasked him with writing about medications that cause worsening of DR initiation of treatment, this idea of early worsening of DR. And this came up because I had a few patients who started on Ozempic and other GLP-1 agonists that ended up with worsening of their diabetic retinopathy, or came and asked me about it. And so he did a good job kind of going through the data and essentially saying, like, we all know that the benefits exceed the risks. Like you should still try to lower someone's A1C if you can. But it is an interesting concept. And just quickly around the table, Kat, is this something you think about in your practice? Do you ever get patients referred who are starting or note this? And you change your follow-up strategy at all if you know that they've recently started insulin or GLP-1 agonist?
I get a ton of my chart messages from like other providers who are considering starting patients on these, and that patients who already see me about it and that they're concerned. So I actually really appreciated the article because I think it really like succinctly went over the different trials and what they sort of showed. To be honest, I don't really change my strategy towards follow-up that much if they're starting on it. You know, I haven't been burned yet by someone, I think, getting significantly worse during this phase. I'm sure that'll sort of happen. But like most of the people I think who are at a high risk for like progressing, like the severes that I think are have a risk of switching over to PDR. I mean, I already kind of see those people every 3 months. So I haven't changed my practice, but I've definitely had a lot of conversations with patients and other providers about it.
Sarwar, what about your diabetics in the city? Is this something that comes up?
Oh, absolutely. A couple of years ago, actually, when I was in Chicago, I mean, this topic came up and, you know, like internal medicine doctors were sending their diabetics, it's like, oh, I'm starting this patient on this medication. You know, it says on the warning that it worsens retinopathy, you know, because it works really well. And I was like, duh, you know, like, obviously, we know this from data from like 25, 30 years ago. But it was actually, the article was very well written, you know, especially looking at, you know, the prior data. And, you know, I didn't know that there was a clinical trial going on that would formally study the level of retinopathy. And the what I thought was super helpful is, what we already do, the people who are, I think it's great for people to have a baseline exam. I see those patients much more frequently anyway. I mean, if someone is severe, moderate to severe in PDR, I actually see them in, like 3 to 4 months if their A1C is, in like the 10 to 13 range, which is like not uncommon in my practice, because I know they're going to get worse and I'm more likely to, consider, early PRP for them. So it doesn't really change my practice, but it reinforces, what I sort of already do as well.
Saf, any other thoughts on?
Yeah, no, I agree with Saur and Kat. I think the one thing I always try to do when I see worsening of diabetic retinopathy in my patients, I always ask the patients, oh, what's going on? What's happening? How's the sugar control? And inevitably, most people, there'll be something that has made their sugar control pretty poor, whether it's an event or anything like that. And I think this kind of just highlights the fact that if the patient's like, no, I'm actually doing much better, I'm on this magic drug, and things like that, that to be mindful that actually this could be when you're catching the patients, and I have quite a few patients who, it's been magic for their glucose control and weight control and all that. So I think when I do see patients that I'm surprised about the worsening, whatever situation may be, I do try to ask them anything that's important for practitioners, that it may actually be the new medication that they're on. And I, just kind of write it out.
That's a great point. I would add in, throw in bariatric surgery patients. We have a big bariatric surgery division here at UM in Miami, and I will get some bariatric surgery patients. And there's other things to worry about with those patients. Every once in a while, I'll get a vitamin A after bariatric surgery.
That's half my practice.
Yeah. What, vitamin A deficiency?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Really?
I mean, I'm exaggerating, but I get a ton because patients don't do what they're supposed to.
Yeah. I mean, but these patients can also get worsening DR because they lose so much weight. And again, I think the reason the data is kind of muddy, not to be oversimplistic, is there's probably some patients who they are sensitive to it and some who aren't. And there's probably some inborn difference at the cellular level, but there are definitely patients who do get worse. And we've all seen these patients. So just something to keep in mind. The last one, we won't belabor it, but Susan Worley is a writer who will frequently write for Retinal Physician, wrote this piece featuring Dave Boyer and Steve Schwartz from LA, just talking about retinal biomarkers, retinal tracers. I think this goes back to a lot of the data that Duke initially popularized about looking at sort of markers with OCTA for neurodegenerative disease in the CNS, but they're talking about other sort of markers. And now they have this trial. And again, this one, you can argue, this also feels a little bit, not like a commercial, but definitely, they're talking about a very specific company here, Amidis, that's enrolling in this trial. And so, but again, this is an interesting concept. We talk about the science of it. Like they are looking essentially to see, can you detect these diseases earlier? And then more importantly, can you use findings that are non-invasive to detect the progression, which is hugely important for research trials, which for these diseases historically have relied on very non-specific measures, whether it's subjective tests or MRIs or functional MRIs. So I think this is cool. I think this probably will have some promise as the imaging technology gets better. Safa, any thoughts, reactions to this?
I think this is a very exciting area. I do think that it's one of those murky areas where you kind of have to wonder, when does early detection and early treatment, when will those roads kind of come together? If you Google a retinal marker in the clinical trials, you're going to get about 300 hits. So it's a very big topic, in addition to, I think, stem cells and gene therapy for retina. But I think because our imaging is getting better and better, other fields are thinking maybe this is the avenue that we've been missing in terms of bringing so many parts of CNS and retina together. We keep saying retina's, the window to the brain. And this is where it comes in. So I'm cautiously optimistic, but given how toxic some of these agents could potentially be in the long term, I worry about the mode of these tracers, but I'm cautiously optimistic.
Kat, is Justice Ehler going to be angry that I didn't say he has also done some work in this space?
Well, this article is very focused on, as you mentioned, a specific company and a specific group. But I was opening up the article and I was like, am I going to read something about Justice? I was taking a look at it. Yeah. I think it's a really cool concept in general. I think the idea of like AI applied to this is like fantastic. At the Cleveland Clinic, we're doing a large brain study where we're basically just collecting, like, neuro basically is collecting like a huge database of patients, like MRIs, and all these patients are getting OCTs as part of it. So I think there's a lot of interest in seeing sort of what correlations you can find that maybe like are precursors to like later like disease. So I think that sort of highlights the interest here. I think it's a cool field.
So Sarwar, you get the last word.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, yeah, I think I agree with everyone. This is definitely an interesting area. But I mean, I like the quote from Dr. Boyer saying that, yeah, this is exciting, but we need to know that what this means, you know, how it correlates with, you know, especially with neurodegenerative scores, you know, like how does it correlate clinically? Are we just finding another marker of disease? I mean, for example, if you think about amyloid, you know, it was controversial for a while, but you know, it's, you know, whether it's a marker of disease or it's causative for disease, you know, while people, they were working on some of these amyloid PET scans, and it's something that we're still starting to explore. So while it's exciting, I agree, it's something we need to know that increase or decrease in some of these biomarkers result in actual improvement. It actually reminded me, interestingly, of, you know, probably like 5-10 years ago, you know, looking at hyperreflective foci, like a lot of the intraocular steroid advocates, and I've become one of those as well. You know, when people would ask me, like, why are you using steroids in this patient? And, you know, for a lot of my colleagues, they would say, yeah, it just has that chronic look, you know what I mean? And, you know, there was a lot of discussion about hyperreflective foci and who responds well. Why does it look chronic to you, you know? So it reminded me of some of those discussions, and we still don't know. I mean, I still don't know why, when I look at an OCT, aside from the fact that there are mad exudates, that, okay, this seems like it's a good intraocular steroid candidate. So it kind of reminded me of some of those discussions from a few years ago.
Well, I appreciate you all being super generous with your time, going way over. We're recording this for the holidays, first night of Hanukkah, Christmas next week. Happy holidays, guys. Have a very safe season.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Santa, cookies for Santa, milk for Santa, but not too many, so his diabetic retinopathy stays under control. All right, have a good night.
Good night, guys.
Have a good night. Thank you.
Many thanks to Doctors Talcott, Romani, and Zahid for joining me for this episode. Remember, listeners, you can find all 373 of our podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. Episodes are there sorted by category. Remember, you can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast and in your favorite podcast app on your Android or Apple device. We love getting feedback. You can always reach out to us directly by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website or emailing me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. As we enter 2023, thanks always have to go out to our whole team, Justin Ma, who does the production for most of our episodes, Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Mike Vinikasan, Dr. Angela Chang, original members of the team who have done a fantastic job over the years. Listeners, here's to a wonderful 2023. Let's kick it off with a blast. Thank you for all you do for your patients, the articles you read and publish, and for the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.